You're listening to The Birder's Guide with Michael Greenschutz.
G'day everybody, welcome back to The Birder's Guide. How are we all? I've been flat out driving trucks, but it started raining a few hours ago, so I've taken this opportunity to jump on here, record this intro and outro, and get this podcast out on a Friday, which will be, and on the right Friday too, so that'll be good. Anyway, so birding for me, two main things. So as I said, I'm hoping to get to 30 species on my drive in and out of work. So for those who are interested, if you Google Maps Nantawarra, spelled N-A-N-T-A-W-A-R-R-A, I think, Nantawarra, South Australia, and then Bowman's, there's a Vitera site at Bowman's. Between those two spots, roughly, it's about 20, 25 kilometres, something like that. Anyway, hoping to reach 30 species. I was planning on counting them up before this, but I haven't. But generally speaking, I don't actually know how many I've got, but interesting things. Stubble quails, they're, you know, in the stubbles that we're reaping. I'm sort of hoping to see some little button quails, but haven't yet. Well, they haven't done much driving at night, so maybe once we do some nighttime work. I've seen peregrine falcons at three different spots. Far enough apart not to be the same families or birds, so that's cool. Blue bonnets, ringnecks. That's probably all the main interesting stuff. I've seen black-shouldered kite. Haven't seen any brown falcons yet. Yesterday, I saw a male chestnut teal. I was just driving across a bridge, and there's a little pond of water. Wouldn't be more than like 10 square meters. On the left-hand side, and I just looked at it as I was driving past, and there was a male chestnut teal on the water, so that was cool. That was a bit unexpected, but my guess would be that I might be up to around about 20 species, so we'll see what continues happening there. The other interesting news was I had a few days off recently because of another rain event, and a eastern yellow wagtail was seen down at Robe. So Robe is, at a guess, maybe 5-hour drive from my house. So I took the opportunity while I wasn't working and flew down there, although I drove down there. I took the opportunity to go down with my cousin, who I haven't seen for quite a while, who's also a keen birder. So that added like an extra hour onto my drive because I had to drive down to Adelaide first and then across the road to pick him up. But quite a good little day. Caught up with Ian Reid, Paul Coddington. Very briefly caught up with David and Sue Harper, and Bob Green was there. So there was quite a few people there. There was like another four or five people that I can't remember your name. Sorry. I remember Irene, Deb. I can't remember everybody's name, but if you were down there, it was a good day. I was saying to Tate, my cousin, on our way back, I was like, you know, I can see why people think birders are a weird lot. I set my alarm for 4 a.m., drove for 6 hours, spent the next 7 hours standing on our feet looking at literally the same little patch of mud for like 7 hours straight. Found the bird, looked at it for like 3 minutes, and then it flew off into some samphire and we couldn't see it again. And then we turned around, hopped back in the car and drove 6 hours home. And everybody classified that as a very successful day. So weird. But I still think we're not quite as strange as train spotters. Apologies if there are any train spotters here. If anyone is a train spotter, can you email me and tell me what the attraction is with train spotting? You can literally just look at a piece of paper and it's like train 123 will be at exactly this point at 10:45 a.m. You should be able to tick off like every train within about a week. Anyway, maybe I'm completely missing the point about it, but yes, us birders can be a bit strange sometimes. But we're a good bunch and it's a good hobby, and I love it. Anyway, that's my birding for this fortnight. I'll let you know if I'll come up with anything else of interest in a fortnight's time. Enjoy this conversation with Donna. And I haven't actually recorded another conversation yet. I'm hoping to maybe try and find someone in the next day or two, if it continues to be too damp to reap. I'll just preempt this. I've been talking with Ed Williams, and we're going to do a sort of like a wrap-up conversation about the Bird the Feck at Home Facebook group. So this episode that's coming out is my number 48. So the next one will be 49, and then the one after that will be 50, which I'm hoping to do with Ed, because he has reached 50% of the world's birds seen in people's backyards on that group. So that's pretty insane. So I thought 50 and 50, that's a nice little match. So Ed will be up in two episodes time. Hopefully someone else will be up soon. I have been... Oh, the book's not on my desk. I've been reading a book by Martin Painter. Pretty sure that's his name. Sorry, Martin, if you're listening. Painter? Planter? I think it's Painter. about birding. It's called Birding in the Age of Extinction. And it's a really good book, and I'm really enjoying it, but I haven't quite finished it yet. So I'll get Martin on once I've finished that book, and we will discuss that. But that's a really good read. I'm very much enjoying it so far. Anyway, rambling on. Enjoy this conversation with Donna. We'll chat to you again in a fortnight. Donna, welcome to the Birder's Guide. It's great to have you on the show.
Thanks. Thanks for having me.
Now, I want to start this off in a slightly different direction to how we normally... Sorry, it's my wife just giving me a thumbs up to say we're going. a different direction than normal. So... I've seen your name around a few times. I think we're both on Mike Potter's Facebook chat, I think, his big year. And I see your name on eBird checklists and stuff when I'm looking for places I need to go on tours. So I reached out and said, do you want to come on the show? And you kindly agreed. So thank you very much. And then I did a little bit more digging. And the more I looked into what you had done and what you are doing, the more interesting stuff I came across, which is fantastic. But one thing I learned about 2 days ago, so backtracking a little bit, a few years ago, Damien Baxter, I think, put out a competition for someone to win a trip to join his tour to Christmas and Cocos Island. And I remember it because... the rule was at the time of the trip, you had to be under 30, and I was 30 and a half. So I was a bit disappointed about that, but that's right. But anyway, about 2 days ago, I learned that you were the person that won that competition. So how was that? Did you go on the trip? Yeah. How was it?
It was incredible. Yeah, I felt very lucky and privileged to be the recipient of that really great initiative put forward by Richard Baxter, just to try and encourage younger people who may not necessarily have the funds to go on a tour like that. So the tours tend to be dominated by a bit of an older demographic. And so I think he wanted to encourage really keen birders who would otherwise probably give that kind of thing a miss. It was really, really good. I hadn't really done any kind of hardcore vagrant hunting before.
Yeah.
So it was a really awesome experience to go around and see all the kind of specialties on Cocos and Christmas Island, but then also just run around like crazy, just trying to find as many interesting, cool things as we could. And we did find a couple of good things, including an Asian brown flycatcher on Cocos, and we had a couple of pond herons as well. Mm-hmm. And had a ball, really. Yeah. They're both, each for different reasons, amazing places to go. Like, I would probably consider going back just even for a holiday, because they were pretty awesome. So,
yeah. How long was the trip for?
It was, I think, 10 days. It was either 10 days or 2 weeks. I can't quite remember now, but it was kind of roughly divided between the two places.
Yeah. So a reasonable, yeah. reasonable amount of time.
A reasonable amount of time, yeah. Plenty of time for that vagrant hunting and
yeah.
Just to really get a feel for both places.
Yeah. You didn't happen to add anything to the Australian, official Australian list while you were there, did you?
No, unfortunately. I think that they had added a couple of things maybe on the previous trip before we went. Because I think that the December trip tends to be a little bit more successful in that regard. But the trip yeah. that I went on was in January.
Yeah.
So always fingers crossed, but the chances I think were always just that little bit lower.
yeah. Well, you never know places like that.
Yeah.
Although I've never been to either of them, but one day. I would have very much yeah. have liked to win that competition, but I was too old. That's okay. So what about yourself? How did you get into birding in the first place?
So it's maybe a little bit of a slower start than a lot of birders had. So I was kind of always interested in nature and wildlife as a kid, and not like anything in particular, but just like general yeah. animals, plants, everything like that. But my dad did have a copy of the Cayley's What Bird Is That? And I mm-hmm. remember spending quite a lot of time as a kid just flipping through and looking at the pretty paintings and yeah. marveling over the birds. But then it wasn't really until I got to uni and I was studying under Associate Professor David Payton at University of Adelaide, and he's yep. Kind of one of the top ornithologists mm. definitely in South Australia, but probably in the country as well. And obviously that's his area of expertise. And so quite a lot of what he talked about in his lectures, and then later on when we did a field course, was bird related. So I got really interested in the work that he was doing, and ended up signing on for an honours project with him, which was at the Arab Recovery Reserve. So that's up near the Olympic Dam yep. mine, near Roxby Downs. Mm-hmm. And I was really keen to kind of do a bird focused project. So it was studying the chestnut-rumped thornbill. So that was kind of a little study looking at their habitat requirements and how different factors inside and outside the fence might influence their movements and their distribution and things like that.
Mm.
But I guess kind of what really kicked off my birding in the sense of like keeping lists and everything like that was that there was a significant rain event while I was up there doing my project. So in the arid lands, when there's a significant rain event, it's a really exciting time because all birds from everywhere come to where the rain has fallen in ways that we don't even really understand. So like chats showed up overnight, and water birds, and all kinds of really cool things that I'd never seen before, because everything up there pretty much was new for me.
Yeah.
And I just started keeping a list of everything that I was seeing, and I was adding and adding to it, and had some really cool experiences of like trying to identify birds that I hadn't seen. Like we had a ground cuckoo shrike flyover calling, and right. I had no idea what it was. And so I went through the entire Morecambe app of calls, listening to every single one until I found and was able to identify it. And yeah. I kind of got hooked from there. And then when I moved across to Canberra for my PhD, I met people at uni who were birders, and a lot of them had already seen like 3 or 4 times the amount that I had seen. And I've got a little bit of a competitive edge as well. So I was like, oh, I got to catch up. I've got to like get into the big leagues.
Yeah.
So yeah, like basically went from there.
So you didn't, what did you study at uni?
I did a Bachelor of Science majoring in ecology, botany and environmental geoscience, and then okay. with an honours project in environmental biology as well.
So you didn't really get into birding until like early to mid 20s.
Yeah, so I was 22 when I was doing my honours.
Okay.
And then after my honours, I took a year off before starting my PhD the following year.
Yeah.
So yeah, kind of like mid 20s was when I really started like getting into it pretty seriously.
So let's think about this then, because that's fairly, well, it's not late for a lot of people, but you have seen over 700 species in Australia.
Mm-hmm.
You tell me that you're 30 and yes. that you were 29 when you found your 700th.
Yes.
So that means essentially you found 700 Australian species in 6 years.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's intense. That's intense. How did you?
Yes.
Tell me how you managed to do that, because I haven't seen close to 700 and I've been birding, well, 2.5 times that long. So how did you manage to achieve that?
Yeah, so I guess I've got a few things kind of in my favor. One being that because I'm an ecologist, I've often been paid to travel for work.
Yeah.
And I spent a couple of years working for Australian Wildlife Conservancy. So I got to move around to a lot of their different sanctuaries to areas that are or can be quite an undertaking to get to. So for example, I spent a bit of time living in the Kimberley and traveled extensively through Northern Australia. But also in addition to like paid work, I've also volunteered quite a lot on ecological projects in different parts of the country.
Mm-hmm.
So for example, in 2018, when I did a kind of big year that wasn't really an official big year because it wasn't really planned, so to speak, I ended up volunteering in the Pilliga, in the Mallee, went to volunteer on a banding project in Iron Range. So that took me mm-hmm. up to Cape York, where I had never been before. So definitely being an ecologist and being paid to do bird surveys and other ecology work has helped. But I've also kind of always loved to travel, not only for birding, but for other reasons. So I've kind of made little trips here and there where I've been able to clean up certain regions. Like again, in 2018, I took a solo trip where I did a road trip around Southwest WA.
Oh, yeah.
And got all those species down there.
Yep.
Went to Tassie to do an eagle hawk neck pelagic and then got all those species down there. I think I did another trip in 2018, which was a solo trip to Darwin, because there was a black-headed gull that had shown up. And that was my first like actual twitch where I was like, oh, I need to see that. So I went up and because I hadn't birded up there before, managed to clean up most of the specialties in that area. So yeah, it's kind of been a mishmash of work and then like travel and a lot of volunteering, and everything's kind of just fallen into place. But I guess one of the downsides to the way that I've gone about it is that I've missed kind of things all over the country. I don't have just one region anymore that I can go to get whatever's left. I have to go back to, you know, wherever it might be to clean up that one species that I didn't get to.
I have two main areas like that. Tasmania, would you believe it? The only thing that I haven't seen in Tasmania is a dusky robin.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I've seen every other endemic, but not the dusky robin. And the Kimberley, I have to go all the way back to the Kimberley for a Kimberley honey eater. Everything else.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So, the Kimberley honey eater can be tricky.
Yeah. So it's annoying, but at the same time, it's nice to have a reason to go back to these places.
Oh, for sure. Yeah.
Something. So this is a question that I always find interesting. I don't suppose he'll mind me saying his name. So Peter, my boss, Peter Wanders. Do you know Peter Wanders?
Yeah, I met Pete actually recently because we were both down trying to see the Antarctic terns at
McDonald's. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
I think I beat you there by a day. I think I was there the day before everybody else went. So his 700th bird was the buff-breasted paradise kingfisher. And I always find it interesting what people's 700th bird is. Not that I have one, but because the paradise kingfisher for me was like number, I don't know, 410 or something. Mm-hmm. So it's always interesting to see how far people get through their list before they reach, you know, because 700 birds, that there's not many left to find, really. So the question is, what was your 700th bird?
So my 700th was Red Blood Whistler. And oh, yeah. It was my absolute bogey bird for many, many years.
Yep.
I'd been on numerous trips to like Round Hill and Yathong, looked for them in South Australia as well previously, and had always dipped despite spending hours and hours looking for them. And then I went to Nombini, which is near Round Hill Nature Reserve in New South Wales with my partner Ashwin. And it was miserably cold, like freezing. Yep. Kind of woke up with all our camping gear covered in ice.
Yep.
And missed it on the first morning that we were there. We had previously missed it like a few weeks earlier when we went looking. Same weather conditions, like absolutely miserably cold.
Mm-hmm.
And then the last morning that we were there, we again, like at dawn, as we had been doing, got up super early, traipsed up and down, like waiting to hear one call, heard one calling and fanged it into the bush, trying to track it down. And we had like, it had stopped calling and mm-hmm. we were like, oh, well, maybe we'll just wander over there because we think that that's like roughly where we might have heard it. And then Ashwin went off to take a whiz behind a bush and I saw something flush as he went over there. And I was like, oh my God, okay, this is probably not going to be anything, but let's just try pishing and see if it'll come back in.
Yeah.
And sure enough, it was a red blood whistler. Yeah, nice. A nice male. And then we found a nest as well.
Oh, sweet.
So it was like the most satisfying 700th that I could have imagined, not only because I'd dipped on it so many times, but because we got like such great views and we found a nest of this threatened species. So yeah, pretty, pretty special.
Yeah, nice. What's your current bogey bird, if you have one?
Brown skua. I have been on so many pelagics and still not connected with a brown skua, and it's starting to get a bit annoying.
What number are you up to now?
721.
Okay.
Yeah.
So you've added a few more since then.
Yes.
Yeah,
just
nice.
A few.
So you mentioned previously that you did your honours and then took a year off and then started your PhD. What did you do for your PhD? Are you still doing that?
No, so I finished my PhD, I handed in my thesis at the end of 2019, and then after revisions and stuff, it was awarded mid last year.
Okay.
So it was studying woodland birds and how they respond to revegetation on farms.
Yeah.
So it was kind of an offshoot of a long-term study that my supervisor, Professor David Linnemeyer, has been doing for many years in the Southwest Slopes bioregion of New South Wales. So basically, like they've collected a lot of long-term data about which bird species you tend to find in plantings versus in remnant habitats. And what my project looked at specifically was kind of trying to collect a bit of more population-oriented data to see whether the patches could actually support resident populations. So I looked at breeding and nesting and tagged individual birds to see whether they were staying there over multiple years, as opposed to the usual approach, which is just go there and do a survey and see what's there at that particular moment. So that was a pretty good project.
Yeah. So at the end of that, what did you find out? What was your findings?
Yeah, so a few interesting findings. Just a couple that I can briefly talk about was that when, like in previous studies, often you find that the biggest patches have the most diversity and the greatest abundance of birds. But in my study, I found that breeding activity and nesting success was actually higher in the smaller patches. And I couldn't really sort out why that was in the time frame that I had for my study, but it could be due to like lower predator abundances or something to do with food resources or anything like that. But it's really useful information because a lot of the time there's this approach of like, oh, bigger is always better. Like definitely make sure your plantings are as huge as possible. But there is still value in implementing a small planting if that's all you've got the funding or the money for, like it's still going to be beneficial for
a lot of the woodland. On a practical sense, what do you like, how much size is small and big?
So in my study, so my study, the small ones were kind of around the like less than 3 hectares.
Okay, kind so of small, size, and like then properly small.
Pretty small, yeah. So a lot of them were just little shelter belts or windbreaks. And then the big ones were anywhere from about 3 hectares to about 10 hectares. So in the scale of like restoration projects, arguably all of my sites were like small, but, you know, like huge, large scale corridors are kind of a different thing. They don't tend to get implemented on just your average farm. So
Yeah. Do you think that your findings are scalable to that size, or are they just completely different beasts? And
yeah, I think it would be different because when you've got much bigger habitat patches, there are different processes operating, and certain species won't even occupy the tiny plantings that I was working in. So you'd be looking at a slightly different bird community that you'd be supporting as well.
Yeah. And so you mentioned in a messaging back and forwards before we had this conversation that as part of your PhD you became a qualified bird bander. Does that mean to someone, so I don't really have any experience with bird banding, but does that mean that essentially you are allowed to just go and catch and band birds for your own interest whenever you want?
Well, yes and no. So bird banding is actually quite heavily regulated in Australia. So there's an office within the Federal Environment Department called the Australian Bird and Bat Banding Scheme that administers all of everything to do with bird banding. So as an A-class licensed bird bander, yes, I can set up projects and then run them on my own, but it all has to be approved by the ABS, and I would also have to get ethics approval. They also give out the bans, so you have to be assigned bans to a particular project. So I can't just decide to go and set up some nets in my backyard without permission and just start tagging virtually. Unfortunately, it doesn't work like that. But there's also a lot of opportunities around the country because there's these things called cooperative banding sites.
Yeah. Which sorry, actually, if you can hear my daughter crying outside my window.
Okay.
I don't know if you can or not, but she just fell.
No, over. I can't hear.
Cooperative banding.
Yeah, so there's cooperative banding sites scattered around the country, which are usually kind of administered by one A-class bander, but then other A-class banders can kind of go and set up nets and band there and contribute to kind of the long-term data set that's being collected at those sites.
Yeah, nice. So since you've finished your PhD, what are you doing currently?
So I am currently working for the Federal Environment Department in the Terrestrial Threatened Species section. And this is a job that's come about basically because a whole bunch of money was assigned for the bushfire recovery from the 2019 to 20 bushfires. Yep. So a whole bunch of contractors, including myself, were brought on board to do listing assessments for threatened species and also to help with the conservation planning and recovery plan development.
Yep.
So that is basically my job in a nutshell.
Are there any particular, are you working with birds or is this more of like a, does terrestrial mean non-birds?
Terrestrial does mean non-birds.
Yeah.
Basically it's like either terrestrial or marine.
Yeah.
So I've worked on quite a range of species. My supervisor is actually quite good though at like giving me birds because he knows that I'm interested in them. And I've got prior knowledge that's relevant.
Yeah.
But I have done plants, mammals. I haven't worked on any reptiles yet, but I'm hoping I will in the future. But just as a couple of examples, I've written conservation advice for the Capricorn yellow chat, the buff-breasted button quail, the regent parrot, eastern subspecies, and the northern quoll recently.
Yeah, nice. Did you say the buff-breasted button quail?
Yeah, buff-breasted button quail.
So
the most controversial of all.
Yeah. I actually did a actually did a conversation for this podcast with John Young yesterday,
okay,
which will be coming out
right
today, actually. So, but that was on Night Parrots. That was on a different.
Okay.
Bird. But anyway, if buff-breasted button quails turn up, have another chat with him. anyway, just an interesting segue there. So, in practical terms, your current work that you do, I can't remember what you said it was, but
conservation advices and recovery plans.
Conservation advice. That's what I was looking for. What does that entail on like a day-to-day basis? How do you as an individual decide what conservation advice to give?
Yeah, so basically the process involves kind of compiling all the research on the species. So I spend a lot of time trawling through literature and summarizing papers and collecting all the relevant information that you would probably want as background information to the species. Then we have a section in the conservation advice where you detail all the threats and the ways in which different threatening processes might be impacting on that particular species. So this is where having a background in ecology and conservation really comes in handy, because I've worked firsthand on a lot of those processes, and I'm kind of familiar with a lot of the different ways in which they can affect different species and different types of taxa. And then we develop like conservation actions and objectives. So the idea is kind of you have a couple of objectives, which really what you're doing is putting out an idea of like what you want to achieve for the species over the life of the plan or the conservation advice.
Yeah.
So for example, with say the regent parrot, you might want to increase its population by a certain percentage so that then it might be eligible for downlisting at a later stage, which is ultimately the goal. Like you want to recover the species so that it's no longer threatened.
Yeah.
So then we come up with actions that are tied to the threats that are that you've kind of already detailed, and we also consult with like state and territory governments and other interested stakeholders as part of that process too.
So because the funding you said came out of the recent bushfires, does that mean that a lot of what you're looking at is bushfire related, or is it just that's just why the money got put there in the first place?
Yeah, so the actual bushfire-related species have actually mostly ended up being done by a different section, but then because that's taken capacity away from that section to do other things, some of the contractors have ended up doing other stuff. So I haven't really worked on much of the bushfire stuff since I started about a year ago, but I probably will be doing a bit more of that in the next few months.
Yeah. So if you could work on any project at some point in the future, what would you like to work on? Do you have any sort of dream projects or dream species?
I mean, ideally, I would like to have like hands-on involvement in research that was kind of centered on large-scale conservation projects that kind of... Yeah, because I guess like my passion is threatened species conservation, and it probably always will be, I'd say. And so I'd love to work on kind of large scale projects that deliver wide ranging benefits to threatened species, and helping with the design and monitoring of projects like that, and conducting research so that we can kind of learn what conservation interventions work the best and which ones are most cost effective and which ones have different benefits for different species or assemblages. So I'd love to work on that kind of thing.
You don't have any species in particular that take your fancy? Threatened species?
I mean, working on birds would be ideal, but I'm also interested in so many other aspects of the Australian biota, so I'd be pretty happy with most things, I think.
Yeah, nice. So this is backtracking a lot of questions, but mm-hmm. you you mentioned, I can't remember if you mentioned it in this conversation or not, but previously we have just over messaged that you and your partner, Ashwin, do a fair bit of birding together. Is there, yes. Do you have a bit of rivalry about who's in front of who or who's seen what, or is it not so much?
Not really, because he's been birding since he was a child, so I have no realistic hope of ever catching him. So I've just accepted that.
He can't be that far in front of you, can he?
I think he's about 30 species in front of me, and most of that is vagrants.
Okay.
So basically, if I was ever going to catch him, I would have to hope that every single vagrant that he's ever seen again came to Australia and I was able to go and see it, which is basically an impossible ask.
Yeah.
However, I do kind of relish when I close the gap just a little bit.
Yeah. Yeah.
But rather than having a rivalry, we actually keep a joint list of all the birds we've actually seen together.
Mm-hmm.
And that is over 600 now.
Oh, that's all right.
So
have you seen
we
anything?
We feel like that's pretty good.
Yeah, that's good. Have you seen anything that he hasn't seen?
Yes, I have seen chestnut-backed button quail, and I've seen golden-shouldered parrot and black-backed butcher bird that he hasn't seen, and a couple of vagrants as well, so like the black-headed gull and maybe something else, but I can't remember off the top of my head.
Yeah.
But there's a handful. it's a small list, but it exists.
Not many vagrants in there, though, that he's just has to sit and wait for things to turn up.
Nah.
He can just go find them. That's a bit sad.
Yeah. Yeah.
I didn't tell you I was going to ask this question, but I'll just ask it anyway. Is there anything out of all of your research and study and work that you've done that you think would be worth mentioning that people might find interesting? I know that's hard off the top of your head, just like that, but ask the question anyway.
Well, I think that maybe it just might be worth kind of spruiking bird banding a little bit more, because I feel like it's a bit of an underrated research tool.
Mm-hmm.
And some people think that it's a bit old fashioned, but at this stage, there isn't really anything else that can compare in terms of obtaining actual kind of population data in terms of being able to record the longevity of individuals and site fidelity and things like that. And also movements as well, because traditional survey techniques can't really, you know, establish whether an individual bird has moved from one patch to another, like I was able to show in some of my PhD research.
Yeah.
And I think it's also really it'll be really interesting to see if we can get the technology of kind of like bio trackers down to such a size where you could actually integrate one into a leg band, and then you could have little receivers and they could fly around and collect your data for you. Which would be pretty cool.
Well, you never know. I mean, technology moves along pretty quickly. And like you say, hard to be able to tell individual birds apart, especially pelagic birds, you know, because an albatross could end up 10,000 kilometers away and you would have no idea that it was the same bird without some identification.
Totally.
So for anyone listening who might be interested in bird banding,
mm-hmm.
how does one go about that?
Yeah, so for example, if you're in South Australia, David Payton often runs kind of field days as part of his banding activities, where he invites members of the public to come and have a look and check it out. Otherwise, if people are interested in getting involved, you could probably contact the ABBS and ask who the banding coordinator in your region is, because there are regional coordinators and they can probably point you in the direction of a project that is happy to have people come along and observe and hopefully participate as well.
Mm. Are volunteers useful for bird banding exercises?
Yeah, well, normally banders can run projects by themselves, but it's always useful to have people to like scribe if you're not comfortable or experienced in actually handling the bird, so you can write the data down and help with gear and things like that. So yeah, but it's just a really great way of, I think a lot of people who are interested in birds can feel really excited and have a great experience of actually getting to see birds up close as well, and really like appreciate them in a different way than you do when you're just looking at it through the binoculars or from a photo.
Yeah, I was reading somewhere, I don't think it was something that you wrote, but it might have been. I was reading somewhere that it was on a ABA, American Birding Association podcast. They're talking about how even experienced birders, perhaps less relevant in Australia, I think they're talking about warblers in America, that when you're holding a bird in your hand, even experienced birders can have trouble identifying it because it's just so different to seeing it out in the wild.
Yeah. Mm. No, I can definitely see that being problematic for particularly like things like the warblers.
Yeah.
Things that look
similar.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think that was essentially everything that I was hoping to ask you. Maybe I'll have to get in touch with Ashwin and get him on, and we can talk about how he's seen more birds than you have and his experience. But one question I ask everybody who comes on, what's your favorite birding location in Australia? Where should everybody go birding at least once in their life?
Okay, well, this is a difficult question for me because I did have a think about it and narrowed it down to three.
That's right. You can give us three if you want.
So my top three would probably be the wet tropics of Queensland, the Kimberley, and the Eastern Australian woodlands. So the Eastern Australian woodlands are kind of, I have a real soft spot for that species assemblage, probably in large part because I spent so much time studying it.
Is there like a specific national park or something that people can put a name to in terms of that, what you mean?
Probably the Capertee Valley would be a really good place to experience that assemblage. I love going there. The Kimberley is amazing because of, I'd say, like the abundance of birds that you can see in a short period of time. Say if you sit like at a waterhole, it can be really overwhelming just seeing like thousands of finches and little doves and honey eaters and quail and whatever else come to a little watering hole. And I found that absolutely amazing and unlike anything else that I had experienced in the rest of Australia. But in terms of kind of the first time that I ever traveled to the wet tropics, I probably got like 80 lifers or something like that in a 3-day trip, and it was absolutely amazing. And yeah, I don't know, I think a lot of the birding around Cairns, you don't really have to go very far. Like you can just go onto the Esplanade and you'll see a pretty decent species list in just a morning. And I really love that about that area. So yeah, definitely. If somebody was coming to Australia and they could only go to one place, I would suggest going to the wet tropics. So, yeah.
Sweet. Well, thanks for giving us 45 minutes of your time. And it's been a good chat. Welcome. And all the best with your work and your continued quest to find more species. And
thank you.
Maybe one day we'll run into each other. We only live about 100 kilometres apart. So
yeah.
Maybe one day.
I'm sure it's pretty likely.
All right. Thank you.
All right. Cheers.
I hope everybody enjoyed that conversation. Say hi to Donna if you see her around. We're going to get Ashwin on at some point. I've sent him a Facebook message, but he hasn't got back to me. So one day we'll get Ashwin on. We'll have that side of the conversation. Enjoy your fortnight. Enjoy your birding. Get out and about. And until then, happy birding.